Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. These are the stories coming up on today's program. Papal audience. Pope Benedict expressed sadness and pain for the violence in Tibet and appeals for dialogue and tolerance between Chinese and Tibetans. Defeat for Humanity 5 years ago saw the start of the war in Iraq, and we talked to an Iraqi exile about her feelings concerning the current situation in her homeland. And we crossed to the US to hear from the associate editor of America magazine about how the ongoing Iraqi conflict is viewed there. Hybrid no thanks. We find out why the Catholic Church in England is so concerned about upcoming controversial new legislation on fertility treatment and embryonic research. Pope Benedict expressed his sadness and pain for the violence in Tibet and called for dialogue and tolerance between all those involved. The Pope's appeal came at the end of his weekly general audience. Charles Collins reports.
Pope Benedict made an appeal for Tibet on Wednesday, saying that he is following the news from the region with great alarm. He said he was saddened and pained by the suffering of so many people. He also said that the mystery of the passion and death of Jesus that we relive this Holy Week makes us especially sensitive to their situation. The Holy Father says that violence will not resolve problems, but only make them worse. He invited everyone to join him in prayer and asking God, source of light, to illuminate the minds of all involved and to give them the courage to choose the road of dialogue and tolerance. The Pope was speaking after his weekly general audience, where he spoke about the importance of the Holy Triduum.
The Easter Triduum, which the Church now prepares to celebrate, invites us to share in the mystery of Christ's suffering, death, and resurrection. These are the heart of the liturgical year. On Holy Thursday, the Church recalls the Last Supper. At the Christmas, the bishop and his priest renew their priestly promises, and the sacramental oils are blessed. The Mass of the Lord's Supper commemorates Jesus' institution of the sacrament of his body and blood, and his commandments that we should love one another. On Good Friday, we ponder the mystery of sin as we listen to the account of the Lord's Passion and venerate the wood of his cross. Holy Saturday, a day of silence and prayer, prepares for the joy of the Easter Vigil, when the light of Christ dispels all darkness and the saving power of his Paschal mystery is communicated in the sacrament of baptism. May our sharing in the solemn celebrations deepen our conversion to Christ, particularly through the sacrament of reconciliation and our communion in the hope of the resurrection with all our suffering brothers and sisters throughout the world.
The Holy Father will begin the Triduum on Thursday morning when he celebrates the Chrism Mass in St. Peter's Basilica. I'm Charles Collins.
War is always a defeat for humanity. As the world marks the fifth anniversary of the start of the war against Iraq, how many of us remember that much-quoted warning uttered by the late Pope John Paul in the run-up to the conflict? The Polish-born Pope spoke out repeatedly against the threatened war in the months preceding the launch of the US-led military intervention against Iraq on March the 20th, 2003. And it was not just Pope John Paul, but many other leading churchmen in the Vatican, including the future Pope Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, who criticized the build-up to the Iraqi war and the actual outbreak of the conflict. 5 years on from that date, Iraq has splintered along sectarian lines and remains mired in chaos and violence. Tens of thousands of Iraqis have been killed since 2003, along with more than 4,000 coalition troops. The violence and insecurity have prompted about 4 million Iraqis to leave their homes. Around half that number are displaced within Iraq, whilst the other half have fled across the border to other countries. Iraq's ancient Christian community was already a tiny minority before the war, but bombs, kidnappings, threats, attacks, and the worsening security have forced more than half of the nation's Christians to flee their homeland. Just days before this fifth anniversary, Iraq's Christian community was plunged into grief over the kidnapping and death of the Catholic Chaldean Archbishop Paulus Faraj Rajo in the northern city of Mosul. So what is the mood like among Iraq's beleaguered Christians on this anniversary following this latest attack on one of their clergymen? How do they see their future? Well, for an answer to those questions, I spoke to Suha Rassam, an Iraqi Chaldean Catholic now living in England.
It's not only his killing now. Since June 2007, this is the fourth big attack on the Church of Mosul. In June, if you remember, Raghid Ghani with the three deacons were shot dead in front of their church. In October, two priests were kidnapped, and it took them a month in order to release them. In January, there were three attacks on four churches and a convent. And in March, we have the kidnapping of this bishop with the killing of the three people who were with him. So the events seem sinister, and they give the message that we are not going to leave the Christian community in peace.
So it wouldn't be too much to say that this could be the only way for the church in the Mosul area, at least, to survive if it does go underground.
I think in Mosul, this is what they should do now.
I mean, how do you see the situation facing the Christian community in general in Iraq on this fifth anniversary?
Well, I don't want to seem pessimistic, but there is nothing that has happened so far which gives me hope that things will be getting better. We keep talking, we keep bringing to light this, the dire situation the Christians are in, and in fact, what the whole country is in. Hopefully, somebody do something about it. I can't believe it that these kidnappers who have been speaking on mobile phones could not be caught. It is just unbelievable. I hope somebody do something about the security situation in the country more urgently.
And what's the mood like among the Christians? You've presumably been in touch with them since the news of the Archbishop's kidnapping and his death.
Well, my niece rang me and she was in tears. He was the one who gave her first communion, and she belonged to his parish, and people are just in agony over this.
Do you think it's going to encourage even more Christians to flee the country?
I'm sure it will, unless something changes overnight.
And did you support the intervention at the time?
Not at all. I remember signing the Pax Christi Declaration against the war. I could not see that the war would solve any problem at all.
But have events turned out worse than you could have anticipated at that time, or indeed anybody could have predicted?
Yes, much worse. I don't think anybody predicted that things would be as bad as they were. I feel sad, really, anybody who has seen the country disintegrating into chaos and the violence that has taken place would feel upset by what has been happening.
Many of those Christians still in Baghdad who didn't leave and have stayed there throughout, do many of them want to leave, or are they determined to see this situation through to the end?
Those who are there have not left for various reasons, and I'm not sure that they would be leaving. I really don't know. Some of them are just waiting for the right circumstances for themselves, and they do want to leave. I know that. But a lot of people are determined to stay. They feel that this is their country, and this is where they have grown, and they have no intention of leaving.
And presumably it would be quite difficult for Iraqi Christians, or indeed Iraqis of any faith, to leave now, particularly because the neighbouring countries are not so welcoming as they were at the start, are they?
Well, the best of the countries in treating the Christians have so far been Syria. And although Syria opened its doors and treated the Christians fairly well, all refugees, in fact, fairly well, they have reached a stage when it has started to affect their structure, you know, the number more than 1 or 2 million new people to be accommodated within the services is not a joke. But still, they have been sort of talks with the United Nations, with the other countries to give them help in order to be able to accommodate the refugees who have left to Syria. But I have also heard that in Jordan they have removed the penalties which they have put on the refugees in order to be able to stay. So although there are difficulties, there have been good news also.
But these people that have ended up in these neighbouring countries like Syria and Jordan, often they're living in a near destitute situation, aren't they? Can you tell me something about the conditions under which some of them are living?
Well, they are living on the little meagre savings they have had with them, many of them very little indeed, and most of them are living on the charity of their relatives who are abroad and are waiting for the moment when they feel the security is better in Iraq to go to their homes, because they have no big savings to help them to reestablish themselves in these neighboring countries. They are not being recognized as refugees and are not given help as such. The help they are receiving is just to subsist. And this is not a life that one wants to live, just to subsist.
Together with other people, you formed a charity to help the Christian community in Iraq. What kind of help is it providing?
We are helping mainly through the churches. And the churches have been, in some areas, have received refugees from the areas that have been evacuated, like the Doura district. And these people are living either in church halls or in one room of a house of their relatives, or renting a house, a few families renting one house and living there. And we have been trying to help them through some towards rents and towards some educational facilities.
So over the past 5 years, since this invasion of Iraq was launched, the Christian community in Iraq, which was already quite a small percentage, has more than halved, hasn't it? I mean, do you fear for the future of this ancient community?
Yes, I do fear for the future of this ancient community, mainly also because we have seen communities disappear. Turkey had a big community before World War I, and it has practically disappeared. And this is the time when half of the population have left, half of the Christian population of Iraq has left the country. In some areas, more than half, in Baghdad, in Mosul, probably more. Many of them have gone to Kurdistan area, and a lot have gone to neighboring countries. Many of those are ready to go back, but if the situation remain unstable, they will be leaving to Western country rather than going back to Iraq. So it all depends upon what will happen next in Iraq.
Well, talking of what will happen next in Iraq, do you believe that the coalition troops should stay for the moment, or do you think they should leave?
Well, this is a question which is difficult for me to answer, but certainly there should be some presence in order to help with the general security, although to my surprise, the security has been very bad during their presence, but God knows what will happen if they suddenly withdraw. So certainly no sudden withdrawal. Try to sort of establish a secure governance that can give a secure situation for all the community before they leave totally.
How do you feel the international community, as we mark this fifth anniversary of the start of the war in Iraq, what do you feel the international community should be doing? What's the way forward?
Well, the way forward is first to improve the security situation inside Iraq, and the second is to address the problems of the Middle East as a whole, not just those of Iraq, but of all the issues concerning the Middle East problems that are leading to what's happening in Iraq and in other countries.
Are you referring there primarily to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, because you feel that this is...
Of course, it is one of the basic problems.
That it's feeding Islamic fundamentalism in the whole region.
Yes, I'm sure it is, yeah.
And how do you see the future of Iraq, let's say, over the next 5 years? Are you hopeful or pessimistic?
I try to be hopeful, because because hope is a great Christian virtue. I don't want to say there is no hope at all. I'm sure there's some hope and something good will come, because there are many people who would like to have a stable situation in Iraq. But personally, you know, even before the invasion of Iraq, when the war was being discussed, I just couldn't see light at the end of the tunnel with the war. And 5 years has gone and my predictions have been true. So I hope that I prove wrong and good things will happen.
Let's now cross over to the US, the nation that initiated and spearheaded the military intervention 5 years ago to topple the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein. At that time, most Americans supported the invasion of Iraq. But as I've been hearing, 5 years later, feelings about the war in Iraq have changed dramatically in the US. Jesuit Father James Martin is associate editor of the Catholic magazine America, and he shared with me his feelings about this anniversary.
Well, I think for me it is a sad occasion. I think for most Americans, I think you look at the loss of lives on both sides, and you see, you know, what I would say, what has happened in the intervening years, and it's a cause for great sadness.
What do you think, though, are some of the most dramatic or long-lasting consequences of this military intervention in Iraq that was launched 5 years ago?
Well, I think the only positive aspect would be Saddam Hussein out of power, but I think the main negative aspect is the complete disintegration of Iraq, sort of splintering into Sunni and Shiite factions, and from the United States point of view, also an enormous debt that we racked up that I think is going to really hurt the economy in the coming years.
Some critics have claimed that the U.S. and its main allies have now been drawn into an almost endless war in the region, another Vietnam, if you will. Do you agree with them?
Well, you know, one presidential candidate, John McCain, said we could be there for another 100 years. I think that it's possible that we could be there for a great deal of time, but I think it's just as likely that the American public will get tired of the loss of life and the cost and pull out, which I think would be equally devastating. So I think it's one of those cases where no matter what we do, we're probably going to be in a bad situation.
You talk there about public opinion, and that's changed a lot over the past 5 years. At the time that the intervention was launched, a majority of Americans supported it, but it's not the case now, is it?
No, it's not the case. I mean, the main reason they supported it was that we were told that there were weapons of mass destruction in Saddam Hussein's Iraq, which were never found. And also, there was this false link drawn between the attacks on 9/11 and Iraq, which, of course, people know didn't exist. There was no link between Iraq and 9/11, and I think people, most of the American public, feels misled by that.
When it comes to President Bush and also Tony Blair, who was probably his next key ally at the time that the military intervention was launched, do you think it will go down in history as their most lasting legacy, the thing they'll be best remembered for?
Well, I can't speak as much to Tony Blair, but certainly in the United States, I think George Bush is known as the president who, you know, got us into this war and made a mess of it, basically, and misled us into a war. I think you see that in his very low approval ratings, which I think are hovering around 30%, which is among the lowest for any modern presidency. And, you know, the other fact is that none of the candidates really want to be associated with him in the upcoming election. So I think he's really been seen, at least as I see it, as a resounding failure, particularly on the international front.
Okay, given the fact that as things stand at the moment, the U.S. troops and their allies are still entrenched in Iraq, how do you believe that Catholics in the U.S. can respond to the war in Iraq and the continuing presence of the troops there?
Well, I think the first thing would be prayer and support for the troops over there and also support for the Iraqi citizens. And, you know, all we can do as Catholics is hope that, you know, our leaders, the bishops, speak out loudly and clearly about equitable treatment over there. And also Catholics should, you know, use the ballot box and vote for the person that they think can do the best job of cleaning things up over there.
But as you said earlier, withdrawing now could make the situation worse. So how do you see a way out?
Well, you know, I have to say I don't see a way out, and I think that that's part of the problem with this war. When we went in, you know, a lot of the sort of people who talked about the possible problems that we would get ourselves into were sort of swept aside. And now we're paying the price, I think, for what I thought was really short-sighted behavior that was really based, once again, on misleading the American public. So, you know, in a sense, I don't know what to say. And I think part of the problem is that, you know, we went in there blind, you know, assuming that we would be it would be an easy situation. But, of course, it's not been.
Well, as we said earlier, it's difficult to predict how things will pan out. But let's say 5 years down the line, do you think that the American and other troops will still be there in Iraq?
Well, it depends on who gets elected. I think if a Democrat gets elected, then we will pull out of Iraq. I think if John McCain gets elected, we will probably still be there in any, some sort of military capacity. Either way, though, I think that significant numbers of the troops will come home. I think, though, that the American public has a very sort of short patience for things that are going wrong. And I think it's more likely that we will be out of there, you know, whether or not that hurts the Iraqi people.
Well, that was going to be my next question, of course. How would that impact upon Iraq at the moment, which is a country, as you say, that has split along sectarian lines?
Well, it reminds me of something that Colin Powell said, which is he takes it after the name of a store in the United States called the Pottery Barn, which has signs saying, "You break it, you bought it." And that's the idea. I mean, we have sort of broken Iraq, I think. And I think if we pull out now, we leave a really sort of disjointed and broken country with ethnic groups warring and with terrorists more emboldened as a result of the intervention. And I think we, frankly, will leave it just as poorly as we found it under Saddam Hussein, if not worse.
So it's kind of a no-win situation all round.
I think that's very accurate.
I was speaking there to Father James Martin, Associate Editor of America magazine. And earlier you heard the voice of Suha Rassam, an Iraqi Chaldean Catholic now living in England. Controversial new legislation on fertility treatment and embryonic research is due to be debated in the British Parliament in the coming weeks. The Human Fertilisation and Embryology Bill is designed to bring existing legislation into line with some of the recent advances in science. The Catholic Church in England and Wales have voiced deep concern over the contents of the bill and have launched a campaign to highlight aspects of it, which include creating human-animal hybrid embryos for research. The Archbishop of Cardiff, Peter Smith, is the Church's spokesman on bioethical and pro-life issues. He talked to my colleague Lydia O'Kane about some of the more controversial aspects of the bill.
I think we should be very concerned indeed about the contents of this bill for a number of reasons. First of all, it will allow scientists to create embryos that are half human and half animal. Now, that, we think, is a gross interference in human life. It demeans the dignity of the human person, and that should not be allowed under any circumstances. Now, a group of scientists have criticized us for informing our own people here of that because they say we have no intention of doing that. But the point they've missed is that the bill itself will allow such experimentation. Secondly, we're very concerned about some of the clauses in the bill, which really effectively are going to take away the need for a father. And we think that, again, is a highly dangerous route down which to go.
With regard to campaigning about this bill, highlighting the concerns of this bill, has the Church been doing much in that field or Catholic groups to highlight the concerns in it, to raise people's awareness about the bill and certainly Catholic awareness about the bill and what it contains?
Indeed, we have. We set up a little working group. The principal member of that was Professor David Jones at St. Mary's College, Strawberry Hill. And we put together a whole parish pack which explained what the bill is about, went through all the points in considerable detail. We also included a little DVD on adult stem cell research, which, of course, has been producing excellent results, and this is always ignored by the press and, it seems, by the government. In other words, trying to get across to all our people that there's no need for this embryonic research because adult stem cell search is both moral and is producing results. Now, that those packs went to every parish in England and Wales. We've asked people to write to their MPs, other denominations, certainly the evangelical wing of the Anglican Church have also been key members, not of our group, but in trying to alert their members and the public generally about the dangers of this bill. And over the last few months, we've had about four or five public rallies. We had one down here in Cardiff, and I had to battle my way through placard-waving demonstrators who were what they called pro-choice and were shouting and roaring and all the rest of it. In fact, when I got up to speak, there was one in the hall who heckled me shortly, but we dealt with that quite successfully. So we've tried all sorts of ways to bring this to the attention of people, and I've heard from some who have written to their MPs, members of Parliament, that a lot of members of Parliament have had more posts on this issue, or all the issues involved, than on any other subject during the course of the year.
You were talking about David Jones there, Professor David mm-hmm. Jones, and I was reading something about him, and he was saying that that there were some positive aspects to the bill. He was saying it prohibits sex selection for purely social reasons, which is a very good start, although he said we'd like to see that extended to preventing deselection on the grounds of disability too. And he also said, I would be first to accept that the 1990 legislation really needs updating. Would you agree with some of his sentiments there?
Oh, indeed I would, yes. I mean, it's the same with any piece of legislation which is proposed to Parliament. Well, most pieces of legislation or proposed bills, there are good things in it. We're not saying the whole bill should be thrown out, but that there are crucial issues here which we certainly think are quite immoral and should not become the law in the United Kingdom.
Getting back to what we discussed at the very beginning, this free vote, perhaps you could explain the significance and the importance of this free vote.
Yes, the procedure in the English Houses of Parliament is that if a bill is put forward by the government, then members of the government, of whatever faith or none, are usually, if it's an important bill, they're what we call whipped, not physically. They're obliged to vote with the government. But traditionally, there are certain issues when all MPs, members of Parliament, are given a free vote. In other words, they can vote according to their conscience, even if they're members of the government party. That happened in 1990, on the human embryology bill then. Now, at the moment, we're still waiting to hear from the government whether they will allow a free vote. The Conservative Party has been given a free vote. All their Conservative members of Parliament will be entitled to vote according to their conscience. And we've been pressing the government in all sorts of different ways. I wouldn't want to go into the details at the moment. To get the Prime Minister to grant that free vote, not, as I've said frequently, not simply for Catholic MPs, but for all MPs of the Labour Party, because whether they're Catholics or members of Parliament who follow another faith, or if they've no faith at all, they all have a conscience. And a lot of MPs are quite considerably disturbed about this bill. The consequence of a Labour member, especially if he happened to hold ministerial office, if that member of Parliament voted against the bill, in other words, against the wishes of the government, they really would be obliged to resign. So it is putting, from our point of view particularly, our Catholic MPs under very great pressure.
That was the Archbishop of Cardiff, Peter Smith, talking to my colleague Lydia O'Kane. Well, that's all for today, but we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow. And you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.